Welcome, folks, to Taboo Topic. I am your host, Ken Drew, and I am joined by my friend and co-host, Mark Reimers. Mark, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good this morning. How about you?
I'm doing well. It's a beautiful day today outside. Sunshine, and it's not hot, and it's kind of feeling a little springy, to be honest.
Spring comes early in Florida, yet I feel like I've gone native enough to really wish for it to be warmer, so it can't get here soon enough for me.
That's funny. Yeah, so would you say you're someone now that appreciates the warmer weather now officially?
100%. I could probably live anywhere, but you know, I'm totally down with summer in Florida. I'm good with it. I know how to cope, and besides, there's air conditioning to retreat to if I really have to. Yeah, humidity doesn't bother me too much.
Yeah, give me heat over the cold any day of the week, for sure.
Ain't bad. First agreement of the podcast. Right.
Yes, there you go. Speaking of degrees, when it comes to current events, there's a lot that is going on. And frankly, I had a hard time just sticking to these two stories because there's just so much we could talk about, even outside the political realm, when you think about, like, even within, like, the reform circles when it comes to the pastor, Alistair Begg, I think his name is. Or there's a new study that came out about the COVID vaccine, by the way, too. That's all from The Hill yesterday. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know about you, but I had a hard time. And, you know, for context, today we're going to be discussing current events, which... Back in the day when I was on a roll recording two or three episodes a week, I did a thing called Week in Review and talked about current events. So here's a modified version of that, folks. But anyways, did you have a hard time just sticking to two stories, or is that just me?
A little bit. I like the idea of, you know, targeting a Week in Review. I have a feeling some of my prepared content here isn't quite germane to just a week. It's a little bit more of a slow burn set of topics that in my mind tend to stay fresh because of the urgency that are inherent in them. But so it's fine. I'm patient enough. I'll try to tackle maybe a little bit more of a current set of topics next time.
Well, perhaps maybe after this episode we can talk about bringing back Week in Review, or maybe every other Week in Review. Every other week we do like a Week in Review, maybe kind of be more suited since there's so much going on, and there's a lot going on overall. So it's just kind of hard to narrow down to two stories from each of us and over the scope of what it's been about a month now since we last recorded.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like my two stories. Well, one of the stories has to do with Montana. That'll be the first story we go over, and that's a little bit more up to date. But it comes to, like, the other story I have, I feel like it's a little outdated, but I still stuck with it because of the fact that I don't think it got enough media attention, at least for the mainstream media. So I figured, well, it didn't name Taboo Topic, so why not talk about it?
You know, and I think that's probably going to be a little bit of a theme if we had to pick one for this session here, is topics that you and I wish were being talked about a little bit more. So that's probably the best way to summarize.
Yeah, for sure. And speaking of stories in Montana, let's go ahead and get started. And I'll go ahead with this first story. So we're going to divide it into two topics per segment. This first segment, we're just focused on state matters. So this first one, we're going to talk about Montana, and then you have a story concerning DC and statehood. So I figured that was appropriate to kind of make that segment about states and statehood. And then the next segment will be more focused towards the federal level, like what's affecting like federal politics as a whole. So, I got some fast notes to give a synopsis of the situation in Montana. So my first story has to do with the fentanyl crisis reaching the state of Montana, which I found this story from NBC, and I guess Montana is known to be like America's last greatest great place, something like that. I don't know. Don't hold me to it.
Yeah, I'm gonna be be a little bit cautious on that kind of a designation because, you know, Wyoming kind of takes the cake as far as wide open spaces still yet to be occupied.
Coming from out west, I can tell you Montana has become a little bit of a destination. You know, there's a lot of folks that I grew up with or, you know, I'm familiar with or just, you know, worked with who decided to retire in Montana after living for a long time on the West Coast. So it's sort of one of those places that for at least a decade previous, you know, coming out of the recession, a lot of people went out there because they really like the culture. It's not just uniformly, it's not easy to define, you know, it's kind of on the fringe of the Pacific Northwest and the Midwest, sort of in between. So it borrows a little bit from both of those cultures. So you get, it's definitely appreciated a lot in terms of its cost of living and things like that because of all the people going there.
Yeah, well, apparently the Mexican cartels are ruining that.
Yes.
And what I mean by that is, which you could say, one could say this is a direct result of the border crisis, where essentially our borders are wide open and drug cartels are entering without resistance in some parts of the border. States like Arizona and California, for example, like have a much higher illegal crossing rate right now than Texas because Texas has put up some barriers, if you will, to at least slow down the rate of illegal immigration. But anyways, regardless, they have found a home. These drug cartels, Mexican drug cartels, have found a home in Montana, especially when it comes to the drug of fentanyl. And another fast fact about this is Native Americans are actually the main target. And why, one may ask? Because of jurisdiction loopholes that bar local and state officials from arresting in these Native American reservations. This allows drug cartels to thrive and exploit this group of people. And the price is 20 times the amount in these rural parts of Montana. One counterfeit fentanyl pill in rural Montana and these reservations will sell for, whereas if you sell it in a city like Denver or Charlotte, it'd be like $3 to $4, and in Mexico would be 25 cents. So that's quite a spike. As a result, people complaining about how, parks like Yellowstone is unrecognizable, and now Montana is considered to be the second most addicted state in the country. So, those are your fast facts. This could be attributed to the immigration and jurisdiction issues, especially perhaps a conversation about like criminology approach. So my initial reaction really is just kind of wow. I've never been to Montana. I want to visit Montana, but from what it sounds like. It sounds like it's slowly becoming a California a little bit, as far as like with all the druggies everywhere.
Yeah, and you know, I think the key difference is, you know, it more of a predominant rural culture. You know, one of the things that you know, sort of transcends, I guess, you know, locations or demographics, you know, or who you're dealing with is, you know, the poverty rates are there. And, you know, when you have that, when you have those systemic challenges in any situation, whether it's inner city or rural, it's across the board, you're going to have these opportunities for illicit markets like this. And, you know, it's really hard to manage it, especially like you're saying, you've got this overlay of jurisdictions and sphere sovereignty that's, you know, in place and regulated at the federal level, making it very difficult for the local resources that are used to dealing with these things and bringing resources to bear, just sort of locking them out. And that's tough. That's a sort of a perfect storm, so to speak. Really, really hard to solve that at the end used.
Mm-hmm.
It may not always be a law enforcement problem, right?
Right.
You're talking about some real societal challenges, you know, to addiction and things of those those sorts, and market dynamics. I hate to say that when you're talking about a controlled substance, but that's the reality. You know, that's a part of that conversation. This is where price can be high. It's farthest from the border. In order to get these things naturally, somebody brings it in, they're taking advantage of that market imbalance. So yeah, the motivation is there. I thought it was interesting. I did a little bit of research leading up to this, and I was reading some of the same material. I think you were talking about the particular cartels that they name drop. I'm curious to know how correct that is, because sometimes the surface level journalism doesn't always catch this. But are we talking about that dominant, what do they call it, the Sinaloa cartel, which has been around for decades and decades? Or are we talking about some of the rising groups? Because right now, you know, across Mexico and, you know, other client environments that they occupy, you know, these international groups, basically, those turf wars are pretty real. And sometimes what ends up happening when people fund, you know, the drug war, is all that really happens is one gets whacked. And then the other one takes advantage of it. And it's not always a given that that's going to be an improvement, because when it's happening is, from what I've heard about this established cartel, this may sound terrible, but it's the lesser of several evils.
Yeah.
And you whack them totally, you're basically whacking an entire infrastructure enforcement that basically tries to minimize its own footprint and because they don't want to, you know, there's a term for it, you know, they don't want to do stuff in their own backyard and ruin their own opportunities. They're a little bit more business minded.
Yeah.
Some of the more up and coming cartels have no scruples, and it's, you know, usually a bloodbath wherever they operate. So, you know, it's one thing, you've got the fentanyl crisis, you know, that's downstream of everybody working and competing over this marketplace. You've also got the fact that, you know, if you're not careful when you're operating to counter these cartels, you may just be sort of picking winners and losers in ways that make things worse. So that's one thing that I'm very, very curious about. I don't have the answer to that in terms of, you know, some of the names of the other cartels out there, but from what I've heard is, you are looking at potentially worse situations.
Yeah.
Depending on how you approach this, if you just go in guns blazing and roll back the entire infrastructure of one piece of it. So, but yeah, I mean, this really just highlights, you know, what can you do at the very least to minimize access, right? And, you know, that starts at the border, like you're talking about. You know, what are we doing policy-wise that's allowing this to take place? Oftentimes, you know, there are power structures in place, and this shouldn't surprise anybody, but you just got to follow the money.
You know,
who benefits from unrestricted immigration more often than not is the business community. And that may be shocking to conservatives who are used to being in bed with the business community and the Chamber of Commerce, but they don't really care where the labor comes from. You know, they really do want the market to be flooded with as much labor as possible to manage labor costs. And there's a lot of different industries, whether it's agriculture, manufacturing, or different low-skilled environments where, you know, they really just want the manpower to be here wherever possible. And, you know, there's a part of us that's like, yeah, well, we want labor because that's an implicit good, but what are you doing?
Well, also, too, when you think about, if from a business standpoint, if you had the option to get away with paying someone less than the minimum wage versus paying someone minimum wage, which a lot of these places are now jumping into like $15 an hour.
Right.
From a business standpoint, it doesn't make sense to pay someone with minimum wage. It makes more sense to pay someone, you know, they can get away with paying minimum wage or less than minimum wage, which, by the way, ethically speaking, I'm not saying I condone that. but if we're talking like pragmatics, that would be the most practical choice a business can make in regards to maximizing their profits. And again, it's not to say that it's right, but it's just kind of the reality. And so, of course, especially like when you consider like, especially when you consider like the cultural background or some of these immigrants come from Latin America, especially, like they still have this work ethic that our country has kind of lost in regard in some sense. And so then there's also like the quality of work that the business person, the entrepreneur, they're also going to check the quality as well, as far as well. If I can get away with, not only does it make more sense to pay someone or to hire someone that can get away with paying a little less, but I'm actually getting more for my buck because I know they're going to put in 110% every single time. And I think when you look at, you know, the average rate born and raised American nowadays, it's a lot harder to come by. And I think that's something that, you know, when the immigrants from Europe came here, you had the Puritans, and they instilled like that Puritan work ethic, if you will. And that's what made businesses want to hire Christians in particular, because they knew they were going to put in 110% every single time and everything they did at the job. So there's also like when it comes to like, you know, on in a way kind of common sense a little bit from a business standpoint, why would you want to pay someone minimum wage? And why would you want to pay someone minimum wage when you know you're going to, if there's a higher probability they're not going to put in the work that you need from them?
Yeah. Well, and I think this is all sort of outlining the helpful context of the human condition and how this works, right? You know, what makes us tick as humans, and, you know, how, you know, the demand for our creative efforts affect, you know, the overall prosperity of our neighbors and our communities and the city we live in, you know, all those things. But, you know, often I think what's overlooked is the fact that, you know, the multitude of special interests that affect this, right? You know, I've already talked about, you know, the business community needing labor, but that's not the only, you know, overlay, right? You've got all sorts of different, you know, motivations and counter motivations to even make it into a political football. You know, I don't deny the fact that, you know, some people are interested in keeping it alive as a political issue.
Yeah.
Not necessarily for the sake of resolving it, right? And that could go for both sides, because both sides can benefit in some way from their base in a congressional debate. As long as it stays as a black and white framed, you know, zero-sum game where nothing can get done. And, you know, somehow we'll never see a bill that actually resolves this, you know, increases options for providing for quality labor coming in.
Yeah.
And at the same time sealing the border, right? You know, it's like we'll never see that because nobody's really motivated to do that. That doesn't raise funds. You know, that doesn't raise political money.
Right. Well, also, if you think about it as well, when you think in regards to policy reform, that which we'll get into like into one of your stories later on, you have, you know, what if you have a welfare system that incentivizes people to not actually go out and get a job and put in their best efforts, then you're going to see a shortage in the labor market, because people are going to rather, if the government is paying more than minimum wage for someone, then again, from a practical standpoint, as an individual, of course, it makes more sense for them to just collect the paychecks from the U.S. federal government with their food stamps and such. And so I think when you talk about, like, you know, addressing these issues from a policy perspective, there's the border situation, but then you have to address like the labor situation. Like, what can you do to incentivize people to actually go out and get And if you have a system where people are incentivized to not go out and get a job, then it's only going to end up hurting the labor market, ironically, and it's going to hurt the businesses even more. So I think there's like that nuance as well that could benefit from when in discussing policy reforms and actually bringing, you know, fixing the issue at hand, the core issue of what's leading Montana's like fentanyl crisis right now, with the drug cartels entering Montana and thriving there. But like you said, that would require to not make it a black and white issue, and that doesn't win votes when you don't make it polarizing.
Yeah, and that's tough. You're correct. There's a cultural rot aspect to it where, you know, lack of strong families, wherever you want to put your foot on it in terms of, you know, are we a virtuous people anymore who are capable of striving? And, you know, those kinds of really hardcore values level issues are really hard to deal with, you know, when you're just talking about this as a political issue. And that's sort of a given. But I mean, there's other pieces that are structural here that have to be acknowledged as well. And that is, yeah, you know, generationally where we are. And, you know, as you count down the generations all the way from the baby boomers who, you know, frankly, they were the biggest generation in history, in U.S. history. And yeah, their kids are the millennials. Millennials are firmly entrenched in the market. They're pushing 40. And the Gen X is between them, and they were pretty small generation.
Yeah.
And their kids are the ones coming into the labor market, the Gen Z kids, mm-hmm, you know, that graduated. There's not nearly enough people in the Gen Z generation to replace people, the boomers that are retiring. And we're almost done retiring the boomers. You know, we've already reached that peak. There is just a huge, huge hole to fill in terms of the raw market for labor. And people, yeah, really don't realize, people just don't fathom the utter disparity in numbers there in terms of the labor demand. And it's, you know, it's not just, oh, we suck at having kids. It's the fact that this sort of was incentivized 50 years ago when, you know, two-income households became standard. You know, that was, yeah, easy enough to go along with when shareholders were pushing that because they wanted to flood the market and depress wages to increase the profit margin. And I'm saying this as a fiscal conservative. I'm saying this as a free market guy. But values, yeah, have consequences, right? Values have a dollar amount attached to them. And when you sacrifice, you know, the long-term prosperity of communities and the strength of families, the ability to raise strong families on the altar, yeah, of short-term profits, the result is downstream, you are going to have a very small labor pool because nobody actually invested in their families. And that's what's, yeah, happening right now. This is the fruit. We have a very small generation coming into the workforce. They cannot support the demand. We're going to rehome all, we're going to reshore vast amounts of manufacturing in the next 5 to 10 years in response to the breakdown of global markets and the breakdown of, you know, global security in many ways. And North America is going to be this huge corridor for manufacturing, processing, all in and of itself. So Mexico, U.S., and Canada are all going to have this integrated role that used to be spread out all over the globe. So we all have to work together somehow. But in the meantime, there's this sort of lawless impulse to just do what we can to get as many people through the door behind, you know, just, you can't deny that that's the motivation. You know, people have all sorts of, you know, conspiracy theories about, oh, well, that, you know, it's just one party wants a few more voters. It's like, that's so shallow. I'm sorry. That's not where the main issue is.
Well, I was going to say, like, that would be like one of those talking points where it's like, okay, that's like, there's an element of truth in that, but there's much more to that than, like, there's a lot more, there's many more layers to, yeah, that discussion that is missing. Like, does it help voters? I mean, does it help to like gain a voter base, like with the goodie politics? Yeah, it does. It's true. There is a element of truth in that, but my issue when I hear that too is it assumes that everyone who does come across is going to vote a certain way, or their minds can't be changed either.
Right.
And right. I think, and so when I hear people say like, well, they want the illegals to enter Texas to change the state blue, my response again is, well, that's assuming that the people aren't, one, already living there, don't have a change of mind about an issue, and two, the people that do live there, it's not just because they enter illegally per se, it's not guaranteed that they're going to be affiliated with one party. And again, people evolve, people change, people's opinions change. My opinion has changed from 10 years ago on certain issues. I'm not the same person politically I was 10 years ago, but that's part of human nature, is that we evolve and we grow. And so,
well, science isn't a science. You know, these things can't really be worked out linearly.
I mean, yeah. And even then, like, if you think about like the demographics of like the Hispanic population, for example, like in the last 10 years, they have shifted more Republican as well.
Yep.
And even when it comes to the Black voter base as well, not to say they're shifting Republican, but they're but their support for Democrats is dropping like flies as well.
Right.
And so politics change and people change with that, because politics are driven by people's and their values ultimately, which gets into the matter of DC, which that is your story you want to present. You like my pivot there?
That's a sharp but on point pivot. Very good.
Thank you. Thank you. I've had some practice. Anyways, but when it comes to the issue of DC, when the founding fathers, you know, created the United States of America, they did not think it was appropriate for DC to be in any particular state. But ever since then, you know, we've had some pushes here and there throughout history, especially in the last 10, 15 years. But I'll let you take the lead on that one, because that is your story.
Yeah, there's a lot of background to this, but anybody that really understands the history of where we came from, you know, how was the District of Columbia, or the District as it was originally called, first created or even conceived? What was the original intent behind it? You know, I think there are a lot of folks that understand, at least to some degree, in fairness to the statehood crowd. Full disclosure, I'm firmly against statehood for DC. But, you know, the reasons are forthcoming here. I think in fairness to people who disagree with me on that, I don't think there's any misunderstanding about what the intent of the district's creation was, which was to not be a state. Where most people differ in advocating for statehood is they just believe it was a mistake. Yeah, that's just the straightforward explanation for this disagreement. They somehow believe if you're a resident of this district, this preset, constitutionally mandated area, that you're somehow disenfranchised if you claim that as your residency and you don't have the ability to vote for a senator or, you know, vote for a congressional representative who can vote, you know, on your behalf. So the remarkable thing is it already affects the presidential election. I think that's already a mistake. You know, I don't believe that it should even have happened back in, what was it? Was it the 60s? I believe it was given electoral votes, basically. Yeah, 1961. 1961, there was an amendment that was ratified, and ratified by the correct process. It was given a proportionate number of electoral votes in the presidential election, so that every time we have that presidential election, it actually factors in. There are electors from the district who represent those voters, and it's tricky because it really, I think it's another thing we should all agree on. It should be all or nothing. You know, this shouldn't be a jurisdiction, I believe, that represents a constituencies that have an identity as as a state or even as a congressional district. This is supposed to be something other. The intent of Congress, for example, this sort of goes back to the intent of what it was meant to be, a volunteer servant leader, a representative. This was not supposed to be a career. This was supposed to be a period of time where you went as a representative and served for a period of time, a relatively short period of time, and then returned to your previous occupation. People chafe at that and say, well, that was really just a product of a certain value system that prevented other people from even voting, right? I mean, not everybody even voted before. It was, you had to have, you know, some kind of skin in the game. You had to own land. You had to have, certain pieces to actually qualify to even vote. And so that there's a lot there that we've definitely moved past in terms of, you know, some of those other structural things that are never going to be turned back, obviously.
Right.
And it's not even necessarily relevant, of course, because, what you can define as skin in the game in our system is I think, up for debate. Doesn't have to be owning land or something like that. But just to get back to the issue of statehood, you know, some of these issues that they're being fought now in the House of Representatives now. So the most recent debates that have taken place have been in 2020 and 2021.
Yeah.
While the Democrats were in control of the House, they passed a simple majority vote, a bill to institute statehood. Now, not only is that, it just didn't get a vote in the Senate because basically it could be filibustered, and Republicans have filibustered it each time. Yeah. It's just never even come to the floor in the Senate. It would need, you know, a supermajority to basically even bring it to the floor because of the filibuster rules right now. But if those ever change, basically the Democrats are just going to insist that all they need is a simple majority vote in both houses, and the president's going to sign it. We don't even need to ratify it as a constitutional amendment. It just needs to get voted on like any other state and be passed into law.
Yeah.
Now, keep in mind, simple majority vote in Congress has created states, right? That's how states can be created, right? That's not wrong per se. However, you are unilaterally changing what is in the Constitution, right? What has been set up in the Constitution. That's where legal scholars disagree. That's where most Republicans, for pragmatic reasons, obviously, and political reasons, are willing to argue as well that it's inappropriate for it to be a simple majority vote in this case.
Mm-hmm.
And this should be an amendment process if you really want to change it. I think that argument has merit, but honestly, might makes right. And, you know, if, you know, the Supreme Court doesn't agree with that, which is where it would end up being hashed out, most likely, if they tried to pass this in Congress, who knows? Who really knows where it goes? Now, there's a lot at stake politically, obviously, which is why I'm always cautious, even in just watching people discuss it, is it's very, very clear. There's a lot at stake politically in terms of the overall balance of power in Congress. You're talking about adding two senators.
Yep.
Who are going to be the most progressive senators in the Senate based on the electorate that sends them there. You are going to add a voting member of the U.S. House. That in and of itself is pretty significant. You know, the fact that is, I think, unacknowledged in it, which the most in sort of disingenuous piece of this among the proponents of statehood is playing the victim card.
Yeah.
You know, the whole taxation without representation, we are disenfranchised. Okay. You need to look at the economic data of this area, you know, and the amount of power that actually flows through this area and is bought and paid for through lobbying. It is a remarkable confluence of statistics concentrated mm-hmm. into a very tiny area. This is like the richest proportionally income-wise area in the nation. You know, there's the highest concentration of median income there of anywhere, combined with one of the highest crime rates. I mean, just total dysfunction. They have a mayor, right? They have a city council now. They weren't even supposed to have that originally, right? This was just supposed to be administered loosely and overseen mm-hmm. and the place to facilitate the work of government, the federal government.
Right.
No, it's its own jurisdiction. It's its own city now. It's everything. And it's so, being, it's terrible. I mean, they do a terrible job of it.
Right. So what would you say then, while we give the audience, because I'm in agreement with you as far as I don't think that DC should be a state. I think there was a purpose why we left it that way. Could you give like a quick overview as far as why the founding fathers decided to go that route and not just make it into a state? Because that could give the audience context as far as why it is that way to begin with.
Yeah, I alluded to part of that. And this is why you have to be very, very careful not to just give in to, you know, this is the end of one party politically, you know.
Right.
And, you know, that's the thing that'll motivate most of the people to oppose it, you know, right. in parties, obviously. And so sometimes you may be tempted to sort of give in to those sort of shallow arguments. But what's the intent of setting aside
role?
Yeah. Right. I mean, the point was to reduce exclusive community. They didn't want to expose the federal government to undue influence from one particular jurisdiction or another. Right.
Simplify that.
So what state's going to host the capital of the United States?
You know, mm-hmm.
We don't. They wanted to take that question off the table. So
yeah.
Having, you know, two states basically give up jurisdiction over a small place and
mm-hmm.
and sort of disassociate themselves so that no state had undue influence over the workings of Congress or have any sort of leverage over,
part of it,
you know, how work of government is done.
So part of it is to avoid conflict of interest, it sounds like.
Right. So now what are you going to do? What are you going to do? You're going to create a whole state and create a whole new constellation of power
mm-hmm.
located within this federally, constitutionally space right. that was supposed to be out of any power structure.
Yeah, because if you think about this too, if let's say you make DC a state hypothetically, which I would argue as well, like you would that would require a constitutional amendment to do that. But at the same time, like, I understand the other side of the argument. Again, as far as, like, when the Founding Fathers, the Constitution itself was pretty broad in its powers of Congress and President and judicial branch. But, and that was one of the concerns with the anti-federalists at the time, as far as, like, there was too many,
right.
It was too broad. But, I would but part of the issue is like there is nothing that says that the Congress can't apply the same rules they applied for as far as ratifying certain or bringing in a state and apply that to DC. So I can see that legal loophole. But that to say, if we were to ratify DC as a state, to go along with your point as far as like avoiding like the conflict of interest and having this pressure of outside influence of a state government, if DC becomes a state, now you have to think about, okay, well, now there needs to be a governor now, because it's not,
yep.
not just enough to have a mayor anymore for the city.
Oh, yeah.
Now you have to have a governor. And yep. then once you have a governor, then you have to worry about making sure like, you know, that both parties are not conflicting with each other in regards to policymaking. And they think that's just a slippery slope we don't want to get into.
Right. And you're correct. I mean, there are I don't have any problems looking for reasons why this is a terrible idea. And it all usually has to do with the concentration of power in places where it's inappropriate or just imbalanced, right? It's not diffused enough.
Right.
And having an extra state, which has sort of a privileged position in terms of access to the federal government and in some ways control of the real estate, right? I mean, imagine they'll try to make concessions about, you know, the buildings themselves or, you know, those will still sort of shrink down, you know, the intent of the district to the actual, you know, property that's being occupied. And I've seen some of that there, but you're never really actually diffusing that kind of power. It's already draws incredible amounts of power and influence just among the people that choose to live there. And that's a problem in and of itself, you know, just the amount of money there.
Yeah, which the whole reason why we have our system the way it is because our founding fathers, they wanted to create a system of checks and balances. And by making DC a neutral district, free from the pressures of being hosted in a state, that in itself is a check in power as well to avoid, not to give one state too much power as far as the influence of what happens at the federal level. And that would be in violation of the principle in regards to just having like a check that says that prevents that conflict of interest. And I'm probably beating a dead horse, but I really do think like that was one of the beauties of doing that. And I love what you said as far as how the fact that you had two states have give up some of its jurisdiction to create this District of Columbia to begin with.
Yep.
Also represents like a sense of humility by the states to say, we don't need this power, have this space so you can govern for the whole nation.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, what you're going to see a lot of, especially if, you know, one party gets a majority or a supermajority in the next 12 months or so, and this kind of comes back to the table or the vote, or if someone's able to get the Senate to vote for it, you're going to see a big pressure campaign that's based on, like I said, that sense of disenfranchisement. Oh, generations in this family has lived here and, you know, never had, you know, proper representation. You know, this is just like, you know, total victim mindset. The reality is you're talking about a very small area, period.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, just, you know, what have we done in the past, you know, in terms of people being, I mean, every single time there's a redistricting anywhere, the worst thing we're worried about is, you know, gerrymandering or something like that. But nobody ever cries about not being represented. You can be represented.
Right.
You know, you could, you know, give people the option of, you know, voting in one state's neighboring congressional district, you know, or the other, just as long as you declare one or the other. You know, this is not that complicated. And, you know, administratively speaking, it's probably people, you know, who either just don't want those constituents in their districts or some other motivation, but it's not that complicated to incorporate those residents into some legitimate congressional district, even though they're living in DC. So, you know, I imagine there's more to it and somebody will have an excuse about it, but sorry, we're not in this case.
No. And, I think it would just be a constitutional crisis, to be honest, at that point, especially if they go the route of just doing a simple majority to make DC a state, now it's a constitutional crisis because in the Constitution, DC is meant to be a neutral district by itself. So now you're in conflict with the Constitution, in the sense like you have the powers of Congress to be able to ratify states, and then you're also in conflict with as far as DC, which honestly the way I see that is, I don't think if I were a judge, and I speak as someone who does not have any real legal expertise. I've never gone to school for it, but mm-hmm. I would say logically, common sense would say you legally speaking, constitutionally speaking, you cannot do that to begin with, because while yes, the powers of Congress does give them to have the ability to ratify certain districts, areas, regions to become a state if they wanted to apply for statehood. The fact that DC is already in there as like it's meant to be as an independent district, I think that by itself is actually enough to, that's not, to me, honestly, it doesn't really sound like a legal loophole. And the more I think about it and speak, talk out loud,
yeah.
I think out loud, excuse me. There's just really no room for it, but
yeah.
It is another issue at the federal level. And this gets into another one of your stories. I'll actually let you take lead to begin this segment based focus on the federal government.
Yeah.
Because this has to do with our national debt. And the national debt is hurting our, really, the dollar, our purchasing power with inflation and uncontrolled.
Well, there's
on that one.
There's an interesting, there's a few assumptions in that baked into what you just said. Our national debt is hurting, and a lot of people have a hard time filling in exactly what is the object of that sentence. So, you know, that's probably even something that, you know, people that spend a lot of time in Congress, you know, have been in Congress, you know, in some ways are responsible for, you know, our fiscal health as mm-hmm. a nation, have trouble dealing with, honestly, because if you're a Republican, you know, it's all about inflation, you know, it right now, right? Because that's in the talking points. If you're a Democrat, well, you know, pick it depending on the decade, right? It's about defense spending, you know, taking up too much of our budget, and we're not dealing with our infrastructure. Some of those issues have been flipped, right? Now with the populist movement, you know, you've got a lot of people that were, you know, Republicans their whole life now clamoring for, you know, investment at home and shrinking the defense budget. You know, things are sort of on their head in some ways. But at the end of the day, what it really comes down to is our current level of spending sustainable, and what are the consequences if it isn't?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's existential, right? This is not something, as some progressives would have you believe, that can just go on indefinitely as
right.
is. And it's difficult to comprehend, because, you know, every 10 years or so, somebody says the sky is falling, and, you know, there's a certain level of urgency, and it's always from the party that's out of power conveniently, right? You know, so the whole
right.
Tea Party movement, probably one of the core, the main core issues that I can recollect in terms of, you know, campaigning that year, what was 2010, 2019?
It was Obamacare.
Yeah, well, I mean, you had Obamacare passed in 2009, and 2010, you know, Obamacare became, you know, the big Republican platform to try to repeal. But it was also sort of the spending that took place. And a lot of those people
that
came in Congress came in on that platform. And I will tell you, one of the things that causes me most heartburn about that is half the people that took on that issue have been political cast-offs now, because, you know, they're not the new shiny toy, and now we just, you know, they're not ideologically pure enough on all of our other new pet issues, right? So I may have disagreements with every single person,
right,
you know, you can bring up in Congress, but in my recollection, the only person that actually stuck his neck out in the last, I don't know, 15 years that served in Congress dealing with the very specific drivers of our national debt, which I'll tell you what they are in just a second, was Paul Ryan.
Yeah.
Now, what do you think of Paul Ryan right now? What's the big, you know, what does everybody call him? Oh, he's a rhino. He's not a conservative. you know, he's a sellout. You know, he's not, you know, he's this, he's this, he's not this. And he's the only guy that actually came out and said, our entitlement spending is driving us into bankruptcy. And before he said that out loud on the campaign trail to earn a Republican majority, nobody had ever touched it because it was considered political suicide to talk about Social Security and Medicare, which are the bulk of our federal spending now. And that's before people are utilizing it, right?
Right.
They will soon, right? That's going to go up. That's not even the only thing that's driving the debt spiral.
Right.
It's really the fact that we're already spending 18% of the total federal budget just to finance the debt.
Right.
Right. So that's something that grows, right?
Yeah.
Because we're not shrinking the budget.
Which, you mind if I ask, do you know the number it was pre-pandemic as far as like how much we were outspending the budget?
Because I might have to do a little bit of a deeper dive to sort of track that, but you're right. Your line of questioning is important, because the excuses that people have to spend in crisis are always an excuse to total sort of minimize something like this. It's like spending controls get put on the back burner. You know, the only thing that we actually accomplished out of the Tea Party movement was the fact that both parties conceded in big ways because all of these new congressmen actually insisted on it, right? So you even had defense spending get shrunk.
I was going to say, I think that was there the last time we actually saw like genuine spending cuts.
Right.
Or you remember during that time?
Do you remember
Boehner?
Yes. You remember sequestration, right? So the whole idea was if we couldn't come to an agreement, you know, this Budget Control Act basically, you know, triggered mandatory across the board cuts. It did not matter where. And that was pretty dramatic. In some ways, people signed on to it, not thinking that that would happen.
Yeah.
It did get triggered, and a lot of those cuts were mandatory. And in some ways, you know, if you really understand this, that was a big win. You know, you may wish that those things could have been allocated in different ways. You know, so that it was a little bit more proportional to where the waste was happening or something along those lines. But that's the cost, right? That's the cost of being poor fiscal stewards.
All right.
And that was a huge win. You know, I think sequestration was probably the biggest win in the past 10 years in Congress. The fact that people in some ways were foolish enough, you know, to their own special interests to have signed on to something like that, thinking that they wouldn't have to take the heat for it.
Right.
But yeah, that's a big deal. I mean, we're already spending more to finance our debt than our entire defense budget.
Yeah.
Right.
It's not even like being allocated appropriately or irresponsibly as well. I already didn't say.
The single biggest line item in the federal budget is Social Security.
Hmm.
And that number is not going to go down. That's 22%.
And all the, like you said earlier in this episode, a lot of the boomer generation
they're just getting
out of the workforce.
They're just getting started.
Yep.
This is,
yeah.
And this is the conversation happening right now. This is a summary of the conversation happening right now within the Republican Party, which is supposedly where the conversation is supposed to be happening, right?
Okay. Right.
Traditionally, the conversation goes like this. One or two people are stupid enough to actually say at some point, we're going to have to restructure these entitlements. And some people are not going to get what they would have otherwise. Right?
All right.
People are not, Social Security is not going to be able to pay out what it does right now. And Medicare is not going to be there unless it becomes an even bigger money pit or somehow there's another way of funding it. But, those people that are actually willing to say that.
Yeah.
Are trashed in both parties. And you may hate you may hate. Okay, this is a tough pill to swallow if you're a conservative right now. You may hate or think it's popular and cool to hate on Nikki Haley. She's actually the only one who said it during the primary. You know, you've identified me as somebody that was a Ron DeSantis supporter, right?
Yeah.
He wasn't even willing to say it out loud.
Yeah.
In the complete, saying he alluded to it, but it was touchy. You could tell he was very, very careful because the populist MAGA crowd, they do not support that. They absolutely do not support touching entitlements. And that may be generational. I don't know exactly, but.
Well, I think it depends, like when it comes to that last statement, I think it just depends, like if you're talking to the average voter MAGA base, I think the majority of them, they are concerned about the entitlement programs, and I don't think they're completely against it. I would say it's more of the MAGA boomer generation, as far as like they're at that age now where they're finally, they're at that age now where they're wanting to get what they were promised by the federal government, essentially from the moment they started working.
They're going to get it. Absolutely. And that's really not even where the conversation it should be happening, right?
You
can't change that right now. But the problem is, if you keep kicking this can down the road, there's going to be a current generation that has to have that promise broken, right?
Right.
There is good. If you don't plan ahead for a future generation, my generation, right? The millennials, frankly, we can't afford to retire the millennials on the current rate of Social Security. We may not be able to afford Gen X, you know? And those are people that are in their 50s.
Yeah.
Those are people in their 50s, you know?
Yeah.
And that's dangerous ground. That's significant social upheaval, because that cost of financing the debt, that's just going to go up as our credit descends into oblivion, right? Interest rates stay up. It becomes even more expensive, right? Because it's that much more expensive for the federal government to sell the debt to investors, right? That's really what it is. You know, there is a little, truth be told, I have to be careful here because I don't necessarily agree with everything that gets said about this. You know, there's sometimes people reduce it to sort of the fear mongering, like, oh, the US dollar is going to just crash. Nobody knows what that means, right? Because they've never seen it happen. You know, that would be pretty significant if the US dollar failed some way. We don't know what that even means, let me say it. But the reality is, you have to take a little bit of a broader look and take a breath and look globally at what is there, right? You're going to have some kind of reserve currency where a lot of people need the stability of a single currency that is large enough to be able to say stay safe, stable. You know, the Chinese yuan is never going to be that. You know, there's no mix of euros or money from Southeast Asia or South America. There's no other currency that actually has a stable enough base to be able to serve that international purpose. Because when you buy and sell those currencies, they fluctuate wildly, right? Which makes it inherently. So the US dollar is a long way from being supplanted because there's nothing to replace it yet. I mean, just to give you context, I mean, the Chinese are so unstable and their currency is so manipulated that they don't even take it for international payments themselves. Right.
Oh, that's
they'll crow about.
That's kind of telling.
But they don't even take their own currency back. You know,
well, that's very telling.
Yes. So, you know, there's a broader context there. This is not, oh, the world is turning on the US dollar. They don't have anything else right now.
Right.
It's really just a matter of, you know, what are we looking at in terms of what do you do when the US dollar gets so bad?
Right.
That nobody wants to invest in it anymore. Or if they do, it just becomes very expensive to finance it.
Well, all right. So with that said, that Mike, if you were a sitting member of Congress, or you and I were sitting members of Congress, and it was up to us to just go ahead and come up with a budget, like what would your ideal budget look like then? And to kind of go back real quickly to, like, you know, what you said about like the generation there's going to be a generation where that promise has to be broken. I think, like I said, like I think if you the younger you get, the more willing they become as far as I would say like they probably would be in favor of like responsibly phasing out the Social Security program, because obviously like we don't want to create chaos in the economy. But especially like me, for example, and I would associate with the Magic Crown for the most part, in regards to domestic, or at least prioritizing domestic policy over international policy, protectionism, etc. But I am definitely like in the mindset of, yeah, when it comes to something like Social Security, for example, we need to phase that out. We need to get even government out of healthcare, because one of the things that Obamacare did was it took over 1/6 of the U.S. economy. So, as well, so, get the government out of things, like Ronald Reagan said, like government is not the solution; it is the problem.
Right.
So,
right. Absolutely.
But what was your ideal like? Because I would imagine like you're also not against like some safety net either, but maybe you are. I don't know. But what would your ideal like budget look like then?
You know, that's interesting, because you know I work in. Let me just sort of give a mindset background and some context in terms of, you know, where I'm coming from. I work in the nonprofit sector, dealing with seniors, and
right.
You know, being witness to how these programs help or hurt people, and has been a sort of a slow burn learning experience. And you know, it really opens your eyes to number one, how dependent people are at this point, and the reality of that. But number two, also how inefficient a lot of these programs are as well, right? Mm-hmm. So people have tried to tinker a lot with Medicare in terms of offering other options that are low cost, like manipulating health insurance as if that's going to help it in the long run. It doesn't do all that much. But, you know, the programs that are true welfare programs like Medicaid, those get distributed. Those are federal funds that get distributed and administered at the state level in a variety of different ways. You know, that could be, you know, to benefit low-income families, you know, healthcare-wise. Those could be, seniors that have outlived all of their resources and they're sitting in a nursing home because it's basically the only place that they can afford to live, even though it costs about 20 times what you and I pay at home. So these programs, which are serving in ways that weren't designed to serve. And so there's this huge amount of overspending that happens because they aren't targeted enough. They aren't subdivided enough, which, you know, that's hard. That's really, really hard to look at and still maintain some level of local autonomy. You know, there's a fine balance between oversight because it's federal government money and local creativity, right? With people being able to oversee the programs and how they're administered most efficiently. So, you know, creating more options, you know, when people are in their latter stages of life and you know, they have no resources. Providing lower cost options where Medicare can apply, you know, expanding, you know, assisted living versus nursing care, you know, those are sort of wonky niche solutions. Ultimately don't solve the whole ball of wax at all. You know, they scratch the surface, but there's opportunities there. We've seen how better oversight benefited like the veterans programs, right? You know, during the Trump years, somebody finally made some progress on making sure that just wasn't a waste of money. But, you know, at the end of the day, the question remains, you know, what do you do with net? What do you do with Social Security? Somebody asked me recently, if somebody offered me, who's about 40 years old now, you know, where I am in the workforce, my working life, paying into Social Security, somebody offered me the choice of kissing goodbye all of my accrued benefit and opted going forward to invest all that I have would normally pay into Social Security into a standard, you know, market rate retirement account.
Yeah.
Right? You know, that's an interesting question. I don't know if I would go for it personally at this stage of my life. So you know, it's a toss up. I know some people would, you know, especially if they feel really good about, you know, their income level and, you know, what they can do with their retirement funds and managing those. If they feel like they have a lot of earning potential ahead of them, you know, they'll roll the dice and be fine with it.
All right.
You know, Social Security wasn't supposed to be a primary source of retirement income to start with, right? You have to recognize that. But at the end of the day, you know, there may be somebody that's 5 years younger than me or further back, or, you know, and they could look at that totally different, and be perfectly fine making that decision. It's not even a toss-up. And so if you provide those kind of voluntary opportunities yesterday, you know, and start taking a bite out of people, giving people the opportunity to opt out of Social Security in favor of something else, where it takes that entitlement liability off the government's books, you know, the projected, you know, what that even does for the credit of the federal government decades ahead from now, is huge. You know, just slowing the growth of that unfunded liability is a big deal. And, you know, I can't help but say that needs to be talked about, you know, 10 years ago. You know, that has to be brought back into the discussion, because that was on the table during the Tea Party years and people just walked away from it. They didn't have the political will to do it. The business sector, you know, stock market bros who want to see more investment. You know, since the baby boomers retiring, you know, a lot of private equity has dried up. You know, all those people that had their, you know, retirement accounts all in, you know, risky investments to fund Silicon Valley, you know, they're retired. They shifted all to safe bonds and stable, you know, interest bearing accounts, you know. And
yeah.
So a lot of that's why you see a lot of, you know, California struggling right now in Silicon Valley. People aren't getting that startup investment anymore. And
all right. Well,
you know, people can only be helped if, you know, more of people's money is available to be invested in.
Well, this sounds like one of those topics where we can have a whole episode focused on welfare, our welfare system in our country.
And there's a point. I will say, just before we let go, you know, there is the distinction between welfare and something like Social Security and Medicare, right? Those are entitlement programs that people are paying into, right?
Right.
They're supposed to be solvent and be there,
right?
They have been mismanaged, right?
Yeah.
It hasn't been, they potentially could have even been managed well with more tools to make them stable. But that requires some harder decisions and more competence and discipline, which hasn't been present in Congress for probably 100 years.
No, I mean, yeah, when it comes to all of that, like the entitlements and everything like that, I mean, it's fine, because it's like, if you think about it, like every generation like has like that soft spot, if you will. It's like, don't touch this. And like, for example, when it comes to like the later part of the millennial generation, which is like, I'm like Taylor, not for example, my wife, like we're at the tail end of the millennial generation. And then you have Gen Zers.
Right.
When it comes anything to do with like federal student loans, that's like an area where everyone's like, don't touch that. But then you have like the boomers. So that's the thing with good, that's the thing with goodie politics, right? Like when it comes to, you know, when you give out all these entitlement programs and welfare things, when there's someone that comes in and says, you know, we need to cut this or we need to move on from this. Like, someone has to be a bad guy at some point.
Oh, yes.
Which, you know, even for me, for example, like, I'm on my veterans like compensation, disability pay, for example, too. And so, yep. like, I'm a recipient of the entitlement program, which, you know, if someone came in and said we need to cut, you know, that as well, like, I would get defensive as well. So,
right.
It's all, there's like a, it's definitely like a situation where, you know, some, and I guess I'm calling myself out too a little bit as far as like, how dependent do we want to be on the federal government to provide these, you know, these safety nets, if you will, you know, and we have to be able to take out our own personal biases,
yep.
no matter like what, how, which one you're the, which of these entire programs, which of these safety net programs are you benefiting from the most?
Right.
And, you know, like myself, like,
right. I mean, we like to rag on special interests, but each of us in our own special interests are me, right?
Of course.
You know, I mean, it's not always some shadowy lobbyist. It's sometimes just one of us, you know, that, you know, sees that has a vested interest. And, you know, we may not have somebody lobbying for us in Congress, but, boy, we may have an interest.
Yeah. And so I think when it comes to all that, which even I have to get, I mean, like I was about to say, like, I would like to get to a point where that wasn't my main source of income.
Right.
But at the same time, like, I do feel as though, like, I do have this mindset of, like, well, I earned it. And so I
yep.
sympathize when, like, you have, like, the boomers, especially in the MAGA crowd section of the boomer generation,
mm-hmm.
when they're very defensive or very protective of that entitlement, mm-hmm. like, I sympathize with them. And
yeah, absolutely.
I even empathize even because, like I said, if someone came in and said, like, well, we're going to phase out, like, the disability VA military compensation pay, or even, like, a vet who did his 20 years and has, and that's like their main income, source of income.
Yeah.
Like, of course, like, people are going to be protective over their own self-interest first.
Well, let me absolve you a little bit of that guilt, or because I'm sorry, your benefits are not driving our.
Okay. I appreciate
you know,
it. Thank you.
This is a very small, you know, piece. You know, the VA is as close as we have to a single payer healthcare system in the U.S.
Yeah,
And
it sucks.
It sucks, but yeah, that's self evident just in terms of, you know, how difficult it's been to administer it, right? And
mm-hmm.
and keep it honest, and keep it efficient and actually doing its job. That's not impossible. You just have to see the limits of it and. But recognize that veterans are.
This is the Irish to me, thank you.
Well, no, I mean, but this is the reality, right? This is
right.
only the total, you know, veterans benefits and services is 5% of the current budget. And
mm-hmm.
and that, you're just a very small subset of even that. That's not necessarily something that overall is expanding at the rate as all of these other programs, which are set up and fundamentally flawed by the current standards of our aging.
Right.
Veterans will always have with us, but as a percentage of the population, it's not climbing to a huge degree.
Only 1% of the U.S. population even joins the military to begin with.
Right.
So
we're
very tiny.
Yeah, and so it's, and, you know, just, I mean, there's implications of that we could get into, obviously, but, yeah, I think, you know, that's not, you know, if there's anybody that, you know, represents a core principle, it's our veterans, you know, that these are the people that, you know, have actually put our existential survival ahead of their own self-interest at one point of their life. And, mm-hmm. you know, if we as a society aren't able, just in terms of, you know, our civil value systems, to be able to acknowledge that properly, you know, we have some problems. So I get that it's possible to have a rogue veterans you know, group in our country that, you know, is a big entitlement mindset. You know, it's possible, but
yeah,
I don't think we're there. You know, I don't think we're there at all. And, you know, that's just not even in my mind what's going to be the question as we go forward.
Well, I appreciate that. I feel
you're welcome
a little bit.
You're welcome.
I appreciate that. And all the veterans appreciate you right now too. So you just earned some brownie points. But I'll tell you who's not earning brownie points with the federal government in general. And that is when it comes to the Department of Treasury and their main investigating bureau of FinCEN, their program, they're not earning anyone any brownie points. And so that'll be my next story. And this has to do with the headlines that were really more prevalent for the more conservative news media news outlets, but even they have kind of like dropped it. Which that's the federal investigators targeting or flagging purchases that have anything to do with MAGA or even religious texts like the Bible. So here are the fast facts I have noted here. The Biden administration, and this is like confirmed with, like, for example, Yahoo News, which that's a pretty liberal source as well. So the fact that Yahoo News even acknowledged like this is real, I think says something. But the Biden administration has confirmed they have been using federal investigators to surveil private transactions, which that's, don't get me, I can go on a tangent about like financial privacy. But anyways, so next fast point is the investigator asked certain banks, credit card companies, and financial firms to report and flag certain purchases, especially the ones that contain words like MAGA or Trump. And what does that mean? It means they basically asked, so this is what happened essentially. And this is based on the FinCEN Bureau, which is within the Treasury Department, which you may wonder, like, what is the FinCEN? And it is, and their whole mission is to, quote unquote, safeguard the financial system from illicit use and combat money laundering and promote national security through collection, analysis, and dissemination of financial intelligence and strategic use of financial authorities, which, here we go again, like, it's kind of an add-on from the original U.S. Patriot Act. It's expanding on that anyway. And really, it was actually passed during the year 2020, where people like Tim Scott like voted on to pass this expansion called the Anti-Money. And this will sound a little creepy, but facilitate the sharing of data between law enforcement and financial institutions in an effort to come and combat crimes like money laundering and financing of terrorism. And you know, so what does that mean exactly? So basically, what under this administration, they have pushed them to go ahead and ask these credit card companies, banks, financial firms, just look up terms like MAGA, Dick's Sporting Goods, even Bass Pro Shops, Antifa, Proud Boys, you name it, anything you can think of that might have a loose connection of MAGA, if you will. They put it like in a search, in this searching data, and then filters out like, okay, so-and-so purchased something from Dick's Sporting Goods, so we're going to report this and flag this. And the whole idea of it is that essentially it's to combat the extremism, and they deem it's called an extremism indicator. Which, you know, extreme in these purchases could potentially, you know, contain extremist views. And yes, one of them confirmed even by Yahoo News is the Bible, for example, religious text. So I think I'm kind of screwed because my wife just got me a chronological Bible for my birthday recently. So, but this really gets into like the debate first and foremost about due process, and also when it comes to, like, you we talked about in the phone call earlier today, as far as having basically a warrantless search through the internet, basically. And it seems like when it comes to the internet, for some reason, the federal government has a hard time grasping that the Fourth Amendment still applies, which I'm not sure there's anything in the making as far as using the Patriot, because the Patriot, it's really because of the U.S. Patriot Act, I feel like, that kind of gave this space to have this kind of surveillance system to begin with. But I don't know if there's been any legal challenges to any of this to where it actually made it to the Supreme Court. But yeah, it's just very creepy, once first and foremost. Secondly, as well, like I said, financial privacy. That is what distinguishes us from China, for example,
right,
where they monitor all your transactions. And I think something like this is just another step closer to getting us to that social credit system that China has, for example,
right,
where they have no financial privacy, and based on your purchases can determine whether or not you're on the government's good list or naughty list, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, what you're getting at, you touched on a couple different things, and what are these sort of flags that get waved to sort of motivate people to acquiesce to certain demands from the government in this case? You know, really it comes down to convenience and safety. So,
right,
you know, one of the biggest motivators that I see for consolidating, you know, a lot of transactions into, you know, more controllable channels, you know, whether it be digital currencies or what have you, and then being able to, you know, tap into them, really has to do with, you know, say, well, you know, we just, you know, they're going to be, it's way more convenient, you know, there's just such a huge volume of economic activity, and we just can't possibly keep up, and, you know, it's become this competitive marketplace, and we can cut out, you know, all this extra expense, you know, by doing this and that. And there's all these pragmatic arguments being made that I hear about. And then on the other side, you also have this sense of, well, again, you'll hook people like Tim Scott, for example, because, you know, they're going to be the law and order crowd. You know, I do not question his motives at all.
Yeah.
You know, I think he thinks this is a balancing of priorities, really.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's sort of, it's a willingness to sort of see everything as just sort of, like I said, a balancing act of rights versus safety and you know,
right.
That should be pretty straightforward in terms of, you know, making sure we hear all people's concerns and just deal with them. You know, there's always these sort of pathways of, you know, assuaging people's concerns about this. But it sort of masks what is unacknowledged, and that is human nature. When people right. fail to grasp just how much people and institutions desire to acquire and keep power, these things just are, the stakes go up and up and up and up, and you can't really make an argument for safety the same way when you realize just how unsafe government can be when they have that power. And, you know, it's not just, I would be foolish to just say it's one party that would use this power only, you know,
yeah.
Both of them, I mean, do it. You know, I don't put it past anyone. This is why, you know, I don't turn a blind eye to character flaws candidates at all. You know, I do,
yeah.
You know, I don't, that doesn't mean I think that I'm going to always, that we can somehow rid ourselves you know, dangerous candidates, but I'm just saying, you know, these things have real consequences in terms of, you know, how people are willing to essentially turn us into a banana republic where, you know, what's at stake when people lose an election is
weaponization of government to essentially make sure that they never lose again. Right. So, you know, and there's a counter to this in which sort of my realism rears its head a little bit, not as a sense of not cynicism, right? This is not me saying, you know, well, what do you expect? Shouldn't bother fighting it.
Yeah.
I'm just saying when people, tyranny usually arises when people don't rule themselves well.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? You know, I mean, something that, you know, a guy like, I was reading a quote by, I think it was John Witherspoon, who was one of the founding fathers, who was also, and, right. You know, what this is sort of, this is pure secular libertarianism, right?
Yeah.
Because they don't recognize that the market doesn't take care of all everything, right?
You're right.
You can never diffuse power enough to where people act like angels. You know, and so if there's a true lack of virtue and lawlessness in the hearts of man, you know, they're going to bring Leviathan upon themselves at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Because people at some point will make that decision for their own safety and say, you know, the world is just too dangerous a place. I'm willing to have somebody run this. And the cost is going to be my wife, you know, somebody's rights are going to be squashed. Some of these liberties are going to be squashed. And, you know, that's sort of the end of some of these discussions when you look at the values level. But it doesn't mean, like I said, that I yield to that as sort of a passive observer.
Yeah.
I still think, you know, the best thing for the flourishing of mankind in general is to be able to maintain his liberties.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to have liberty under law. And, you know, as long as we can maintain that, I'm here to advocate for it and hopefully prevent those tools from being, you know, unchallenged,
mm-hmm.
In the spheres that we're talking about. So, you know, you're right that we do need to have that urgency. The good thing is it's not a partisan issue. You do have people on both sides of the political aisle that see it as a threat. It's just unfortunate that sometimes it's disingenuous, right? They complain when their opponents use it against them.
Right.
But, you know, I have to say a lot of them would be perfectly fine using it because, you know, you can make an enemy of your opponent in the eyes of your constituents. They'll justify any kind of lawlessness against them.
Which isn't that what happened with the original creation of the FBI, if we're going to be completely fair, right? Like it was kind of like used to target certain political opponents that they disagreed with, which that could be a whole conversation in and by itself as far as reforms with those kind of agencies like the FBI, whether or not we should go with the route of reform or we should go with the route of just abolishing altogether, which, you know, like I said, that's a whole nother episode by itself.
It is.
Ultimately, though, I think what you said as far as, like, when it comes to the nature of people and, like, how it reflects the government in general, I remember watching this YouTube video talking about, have you ever seen Star Wars?
Yes.
Okay, so have you seen The Revenge of the Sith?
I have.
All right. So, it was, like, a critique from the prequel films anyway, and they were talking about how by the third film the Republic had already fallen. It was pretty much an empire. It's just, you know, just wasn't officially an empire yet. But one of the quotes that stood out to me was that a corrupt people will be reflected in a corrupted government as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I think when you think about where we're at in society, where we do value convenience and security over dangerous liberty or dangerous freedom, if you will, because the thing is, when you go for like that security or protection, if you will, from the government, that always entails with giving a liberty away as well,
mm-hmm.
in the name of you know, protection and security.
Right.
And when it comes to something like that, which, again, if we're going to trace back to the Patriot Act of 2001, that was like after the events of 9/11, people were willing to just sacrifice their liberty in order to feel safe, which in hindsight, we can say, well, that was the wrong decision. But at the same time, for the time being, when you have that those events take place, I can sympathize why they were so willing in order to feel secure, because human nature is to want to feel safe and secure. And right. When you have government officials exploiting that tendency of human nature, there's a quote from the World Economic Forum where it says, don't let good crisis go to waste.
That's been reused in quite a bit of different forums besides the World Economic Forum.
Yes, but mostly associated with the World Economic Forum, in particular Klaus Schwab. But again, totally different conversation for another day.
Yeah. I'm going to say one thing real quick about the Patriot Act and somebody that probably remembers that period of time a little bit better.
Yeah.
Aging myself here. I will say, in fairness to the electorate, as a counter to saying this was just a straight up indictment of the state of people's mind at that time. Yes, there was fear. Yes, there was concern. Yes, there was urgency. Yes, there was a urgent crisis that didn't need to go, that somebody didn't want to go to waste. I acknowledge all of those possibilities. However, that doesn't also reckon with the fact that this wasn't revealed to be what it was until quite a bit later.
Right.
So you had, the way it was sold to the American public was, all we are doing here is allowing agencies forcing agencies that have their own turf to share information with each other and not, you know, basically work. We all just need to work better. And, you know, there were, of course, a little bit more not talked as much aspects to it that weren't really, I think, sold to the public per se,
right,
more hidden from the public, which was the net was getting progressively wider in terms of the collection of data, right?
Right.
Which it didn't become quite as apparent at that point because the capacity to collect data wasn't even there as much. Technology hadn't, progressed to the point of being able to collect data, much less sort the data and process the data. So a lot of those things didn't happen until, you know, people realized how the policies that were created when those laws went, when the Department of Homeland Security was created, the Patriot Act was passed, you know, the fruit of that wasn't even apparent until, when suddenly a guy like Edward Snowden comes along and says, look what they're capable of now. They're not even telling you what they're capable of. Look what they're doing extrajudicially and essentially breaking the intent of our laws. And, you know, you can have your opinion, and a guy like Tim Scott would want to prosecute, you know, Edward Snowden, and there's a part of me that sympathizes with that in terms of, you know, what he actually did, which was break laws. But at the same time, I have no idea how we would have learned that if he hadn't done what he did. And you'll never be able to take that away from him, no matter how much, you know, you start to not like him later in life, things shift or what have you. What he did at the end of the day, I hate to say it so starkly, but it was necessary.
I mean, if you think about it, like, I mean, in a way, it's the government declaring war on the people, and, you know, they're not going to outright say it, but that's just my personal bias coming out. But in a way, it is kind of like declaring war on the people as far as just kind of increasing their power to the point of where you have a bureau now telling these banks, firms, credit card companies to look up these terms and flag them and report it back to the federal government.
Yep.
We can be put on the watch list, you know, if you will, of extremism, the extremism indicator. It is weaponizing. The weaponization is a declaration of war by itself framework anyway, which someone like Julia Assange, you know, that would say, well, if the federal government is willing to go and violate and break its own laws, at least the foundation of our country with the Constitution, then does someone have the obligation to expose that, despite the laws preventing him, technically, to do such a thing? Which I would land on the side of, you do have the responsibility, especially if you know the government is willingly ignoring basic constitutional protection by the people. Which, again, I think something that stood out to me from a conversation with Tony not too long ago is human technology, or these technological advancements like the internet, is advancing faster than human philosophy. And when it comes to something like the surveillance programs and collecting data and stuff like that, it's because we have not really had a chance to have these discussions as far as how does something like the Fourth Amendment, for example, when it comes to like search warrants, apply in the context of this human technological advancement called the internet, right? Like, how does it apply in today's context? Does it apply? Which, again, I would argue on the side of, well, yes, it's still, it still applies, the Fourth Amendment, you know?
Right.
And, you know, I would also, you know, one of the things that wasn't revealed at the time, you know, it was interesting to hear, you know, from what you remember when the Patriot Act was being presented at the time, one of the things that stands out from what you said about the original intentions as far as how they presented it, you know, increasing the network and making sure these agencies are doing their job. When things start to reveal itself, turns out the president of the United States at the time ignored intel reports or warnings that there's an imminent attack coming, and he ignored it, you know? And so that's a whole conversation in it by itself, but it's almost like in order for the government to fix the problems that they created, they want to give themselves more power. And it goes back to the quote from Ronald Reagan of, government is not the solution, it is the problem, ultimately. So
yeah, it's a recurring theme.
It is a recurring theme. And I don't know, seems like the government, you know, conservatives, we like to talk about smaller government, but I think the government is so big now, I don't think people really know what that looks like anymore.
Yeah, I mean, you know, our expectations change as time goes on. And now then there's also the crises, like I said, you know, the reason we give crises power over our principles is often because, you know, of fear. And it's
in human nature to want to feel secure and safe.
It's what rules us. It's often what rules us is a sense of fear. And if we can locate that fear in a certain direction, then it becomes very dangerous.
Yeah, for sure. Well, all that to say, it's been a good conversation with you today again, Mark.
Yeah.
It was a pleasure. I wish we had more time, but
yeah.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to let you go soon. But you have any concluding thoughts on today's episode, based on the current event stories, before we go?
No, I think we wrung out all of the value, I think, for now. So appreciate the opportunity, though.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And with that said, folks, thank you for tuning into today's episode. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and family members, if you're courageous enough to share your views with them anyway. Or if you have a social media account, go ahead and share it there as well. Please rate this show a 5-star. If it's anything less than a 5-star, please let me know so I can better serve you. And with that said, folks, stay tuned for this short message. And until next time, God bless.
This is a reminder that the Biden administration abandoned 9,000 to 15,000 Americans in Afghanistan. Now, you won't hear about this from the media or any politician for that matter, because the global elite have their own agenda that disregards human life and basic human dignity. So, to the families and individuals that have been affected by this abandonment, know that you have not forgotten. Most Americans, like myself, know, or your loved ones, didn't choose to stay behind. If there's any way I can further help besides bring awareness, reach out at Kenjin_Express. I repeat, Kenjin_Express on Instagram. Spell the word engine, put the letter K in front of the word engine, then you get Kenjin, one word, _Express, if you have, by one in a millionth chance, hear this message. It's not much, but know this, justice will be served for those who lied to justify their incompetence. After all, I believe in God, who is in control of all things, and he says, vengeance is mine.